Okay, while we're playing with this, then I guess all you guys came here to hear about aggressive honeypots. So just by a show of hands, how many people here run a honeypot or have been involved in some sort of honeypot project? We've got a few. So what an aggressive honeypot is a honeypot that actually interacts with this environment, that it's an actual working part of your network infrastructure. So most of your traditional honeypots, you stick them out there, you know, you patch them, you load them up with stuff, and you make a pretty website and hope somebody comes by and takes them over. You look to see what they did and, you know, do a little research and whatnot. So aggressive honeypot's a little bit different. So I think I'm going to let Albert here start off with just kind of a general overview of what we're doing while the projector seems to wig out a little bit.
All of you do know what a honeypot is, correct? Okay, then you do know you have your two basics, production. Well, actually, you have your research honeypots, and that's it. It's all mainly, as you see it now, it's just for research. What basically we wanted to do was move it away just for research. You know, well, there we go. So as Jason said, a honeypot that actively interacts with its environment. Basically, instead of just sitting there idle and doing nothing but waiting to get owned is not all that useful. And then you have some sort of intelligence. And then I don't want to go ahead and give it out at the beginning. We'll go ahead and into that one in a few. And you have production and research. Production, basically, you can categorize that as a high interaction honeypot. Then research is mainly virtual honeypots or VMware. You have UML, user mode Linux, et cetera, et cetera.
Go ahead and hit the next slide.
How can a honeypot environment interact with its environment? Again, I am excessively drunk. Give me a break.
Okay.
You have your update firewalls rule when poison file ports are touched. Basically, is exactly what it says. I see something, throw it in the firewall, block this guy, or go ahead and do something else with it. These are good, and then they're bad, of course. You have inform critical services to ignore attacker. Am I reading this right? Yes, I am. I'm sorry. Again, this is the whole thing of, okay, I see something. What should I do with it? And this goes back to the first slide of intelligent. We have some sort of knowledge of, like, intrusion detection systems have signature base. They have a knowledge of what they're looking for. Basically, here we have a knowledge of what we're looking for exactly going to that service. Now, limit connection speed and bandwidth. With honeypots, you need a data control mechanism. Basically, is you can't, if your honeypot or honeynet gets owned or attacked or breached, however you want to call it, you can't just have the attacker go willy-nilly all over anywhere. So you have to have some form of data control. You have generation 1 data control, which consists of IP tables, bash script. You have generation 2, which is you can use as snort inline, snort SAM, hogwash, which basically can limit not just on certain ports, certain connections per minute. You know, if you see an exploit going outbound, stop it. So you have different generations of different outbound connection limiting. Not yet. There's one more. Switch attackers to represent honeypots, bait and switch. The bait and switch system. Basically is you have a bait, the production machine. You have the switch, the actual switch, the production machine. The whole concept of this is the actual production machine. You have something to offer, a bait. You have e-commerce, you have credit cards, you have social security numbers, you have unpublished text, like the whole cert thing that came out a while ago of vulnerabilities being published. You have something to offer, something that an attacker might want. And that's where the whole entire bait and switch system comes into it. You know, there's no attacker, sometimes they'll just attack crazy, but most of the time they'll go ahead and attack for a purpose. You know, they want something that you have. The whole Mitnick attack, he wanted source code dead, Tsutsumu had, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The bait and switch system. When an IDS detects an attack, the attacker is switched to a honeypot. Basically, we see something. I think you should switch it. I think you should go ahead and instead of this is where the whole defensive part of the honeypots come in. You see them? Wait a second. This is not good. It's going to hurt our production machine. Go ahead and send it to the honeypot. This is the main reason of the bait and switch. The bait, production, the switch actually goes to the honeypot. All the traffic from there now goes to the honeypot. The honeypot is a mirror of your production server. This we'll go into more detail of this later, but basically you have sort of the same information, maybe same kernel version, same distribution, same ISS version. You want to mirror it as close as possible. So if before he had attempted an attack, he did some valid requests, and he actually has seen the actual production machine. When he attempts, you know how you have reconnaissance. Not all reconnaissance is bad. You have actually going to the machine, maybe throwing a 404 at it. See, when you throw a 404 at Apache, it usually gives out to the version. 404 not found, Apache, blah, 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 blah. That most systems won't detect. So not all reconnaissance are malicious. So what you want to do is basically go ahead and, okay, he's trying something. Let's go ahead and switch him. And I already discussed all that, so yeah, I know how to jump around. Go ahead. Now, the main thing on this diagram that you cannot see is the two machines all the way to your far left, they have the same IP address and the same MAC address. We went ahead and changed that. That's what makes it a complete mirror. He can go ahead and do ifconfig, he'll see the same IP as he did for the production machine. This can be either public or internal NAT. Doesn't matter. And then production bait and switch. What? That's you? And then I'm going to go ahead and switch it off. Go ahead.
Yeah. How do you know what's legitimate, what's not legitimate?
Right now we rely on signature-based intrusion detection system, which we'll get into later. That's mainly what we rely on as of right now. We're going to go ahead and attempt to expand later. Here is Jack Witsit.
All right, the production bait and switch systems, this is opposed to the research systems, which we'll concentrate on later. We basically have a first priority to get somebody off our network. Some other intrusion prevention systems handle this pretty well. Just dropping route will handle that. But on the other hand, sometimes you have targeted data or highly desirable data that you really are kind of curious and really need to know who's coming after it. Some proprietary information that you want to know if it's some kid, or if you want to know if there's somebody actively targeting your system and trying to pull the data off of. So you'd like to switch them off and further research it somewhere else where it's a little bit safer than on your production system, where you can monitor it and you don't have to expose your live data. If you switch it, sometimes they'll notice that they'll be gone, and at the very worst, you're no worse off than just dropping route or just blocking a connection. At the very best, you have a little bit of extra information about what's going on. If the attacker doesn't know they've been switched, they can set up shop on the honeypot. They can actually get some things done. Sometimes you'll see the DDoS stuff, the WAR stuff. Sometimes you'll see an FTP server. Sometimes, and this is what we're really going for, hopefully you'll see which information they're going after, your credit card information, your medical information, whatever particular information you're guarding on the machine. Let's see. And again, this aids in prosecution. When they're attacking the honeypot, and this is different from normal honeypots, in a traditional honeypot, if it's being attacked, your honeypot was designed to be attacked. You can't really prosecute that. You put that machine out in the world for someone to hack it. If you get switched over to a honeypot from a production system, somebody was going after real data. Someone was actually doing something to your data, and you can gather additional information and prosecute that. And it's a little bit better than just logging network traffic, which can be encrypted, et cetera. Let's see.
You got a question?
Yeah. The question was what's the method we use to switch them over to the dummy box, and we're actually using two. One of them is more production, and one of them is sort of a proof of concept that works. And we're working on that, but that's not always a good idea. Most of the time, it's actually much, much safer just to drop session and hope he's coming back. The assumption is that the information is going to be attacked repeatedly, and I'll go into why that's good and bad. Yeah. I haven't had a case happen. This is theory right now. I know for a fact about the traditional honeypots; they're hard to prosecute because of that reason. All right, and I'm going to switch this over to Jason, who is in charge of the research side of this.
Okay, so why do you run a research research honeypot? Well, the reason I run a research honeypot is because I want your wares. So. It's a good way to get exploits. It's a good way to find out what everybody else is doing, so you're not so far behind the curve. And a lot of honeypots out there, most of the honeypots out there, they stick a box out there and they fully patch the sucker. And so once in a blue moon, somebody comes along with a zero day. They've got some unpublished Apache exploit. They come over, take over the box. And you get to see the new Apache exploit. You know, you document it all up. You posted a bug track, and you smile, and you say, oh, that was cool. But there's a lot of research you can do with old, unpatched boxes. Do you want to switch over? It's not uncommon to see people trying, like, you know, 6-year-old exploits against boxes. It's also not uncommon to see people trying, like, a Windows exploits against your Unix boxes. I mean, how many people here run Apache and have cmd.exe attacks in their logs all the time? I mean, it happens all the time. So if you want to ask certain questions, like, you know, if that happened to be a Windows box, what would they have done with it? You know, if you let them take it over and set up shop, you know, are you going to get any novel rootkits? Are they going to, you know, do anything fun? So you're missing out on a lot of valuable information. If these people are taking the trouble to attack your box, I mean, the least you can do is give them a box where they can set up shop and show you what they've got. You know, it might be boring, but hey, a lot of times it's cool. Okay, if you want to. One of the things a bait and switch honeypot can do is switch people to an OS or a service of choice. So if you detect a Netscape application server exploit go into an IIS box, you know, if you set up a row of these things, you can switch them over and say, you know, hey, you got a WFTP exploit? I have a WFTP server. You know, here you go. And you can study different methods. You know, if you want to say, you know, how many rootkits are there for Linux out in the wild? I mean, how many unique rootkits are there out there? A typical honeypot's not going to do that for you because, you know, you leave an unpatched Apache box over there and everybody and his dog takes it over and installs Torn on it. So what you can do if you filter that out and switch them over, you can start looking at how many rootkits really are out there. You know, say, okay, you can install Torn here, but hey, we'll block Torn. Now what are you going to do? Are you going to install some other rootkit, something we haven't seen? And then you can another thing you can do with a bait and switch style honeypot is see what attackers will do when you do various things to them. Say, like, you only allow them to get to the honeypot from the source IP they came from. Like, they can't transfer a rootkit down from Packet Storm or wherever they're going. Sit there and play with them a little bit. Give them different rules to work within. How well do they adapt? If you like change the locations of all the subdirectories on the box and let them take it over, are they going to adapt, or are they just going to say, screw this, let's go away? If so, you know, you could take your production boxes and mangle them, and it works just fine. Let's see. Oh, I was with bait and switch. I think you're back up again.
I can do it. Okay.
All right. Some of the problems that people bring up with bait and switch is, first of all, switching valid users. I mean, intrusion detection isn't exactly a perfect science. There are mistakes that can be made, and I'll address some of these later, some of the things that I'm working on with it. Another problem with, and this is more with traditional honeypots than bait and switch, is attacking other sites from your honeypot. Then that's a huge risk, is when you have people take it over, it's usually a launching point for something else. And again, that goes into the denial of service. Let's see. And the exact, the first production solution Albert's going to go into about.
Hello again. So basically, we want to add bait and switch to a gateway machine. Basically, the gateway, in an attacker form, if you own the gateway, you own the network, pretty much. Same thing with other machines. You own the gateway, you own the network. So what we want to do is add functionality to that. The gateway is basically your access point to the internet. So if you want to control the gateway, you want to put bait and switch on the gateway, internal traffic. As of right now, we're not worried about internal. External traffic. Redirects traffic to from a hostile IP based on alerts from a detection system. As of right now, we're currently up to date with SNORT 1.9.1. Even though 2.0.0.RC1 came out, it's kind of buggy. Host bids and other network big sensors are in the works. We're looking to expand, as well as Dragon can take. You can write your own plugins for Dragon. Same with, goes with Prelude. Some other systems are proprietary, so they can kiss our ass pretty much. And you have keep track of hostile state, has a basic login, provides DOS protection. So basically, we can actually go ahead and look, hey, this machine's been here before, or this machine's currently being redirected. We don't have nothing to do with this packet. DOS protection, everything that has to do with denial of anything or protection needs DOS protection. You have active response needs DOS protection. You have firewalls that have DOS protection. So you can't overwhelm them with certain types of traffic or certain types of signature. And logging, well, if you don't provide information, what use are you? You know, you always have to log. The more you log, the better it is for forensic purposes. You want to take them to court or something of that nature. That's why Real Secure sucks, because it doesn't give you any logs. Sorry, dude from the ISS. Consists of three basic functionality areas: switch core, IP tables manipulator, logging facilities, DOS protection, state tracking. Basically, we see something, go ahead and pass it to IP tables. IP tables marks it, gives it back to switch core, which is our main thing, and Jack will discuss. DOS protection I already discussed in the other slide, and state tracking as well. Snort plugin. Basically, as of right now, we're a plugin for Snort. If you have an implementation of Snort, you can, in about 2 minutes, plug in bait and switch and call it a day. From there, it's reading the docs, which you should do with anything, RTFM, live by it. And basically, just plug it into Snort, run it, test it out for a few, and it's pretty simple, basic install. Routing scripts, we use iproute2. To send data out a particular interface based on whether or not data is mangled. Basically, we have two routing tables. We have one for production. We have one for the honeypot. Two different interfaces.
Can I go back and explain that?
Okay, I'll just go ahead and explain it with the data chart. Can you see it? No. Didn't think so. Okay, basically, I'll just go ahead and explain it verbally. You have your data flow inbound or incoming in through your external interface. Snort will go ahead and expect that packet. If it's bad, it'll go ahead and send it to our switch core, which sends it to IP tables. We use the mangling table output, which we can mangle it with anything we want. We can put a 1 in it if we want, precisely, or something of that nature. Once IP tables grabs it, it'll go ahead and send it back to switch core, and from there we do our routing decisions. Now the whole thing works with, you have in /etc/iproute2, you have /rt_tables. When you can make a table, one, and the number you use is the priority that it get used. Same with init scripts. Basically, you can have 100, 101, 102, and they will get executed in that order. And so you have this, we apply 100, honeypot, 101, production. Basically, what we tell with iproute2, if the packet is mangled, send it out production, or a honeypot. If it's not mangled, send it to production. That's basically how we differentiate between valid or not valid. So then you have, as you can see, this is just a snort process. Snort applies rules, bad, yes, send it to switch score via FIFO. Then you go down one line to the third one, bait and switch score. Read info from FIFO. Is it a local IP? As of right now, we're not doing anything with a local IP. So we're only inspecting traffic coming from the internet interface. Okay, cool. And then I can't see. Okay, this is where the DOS protection comes in. Is you have too many IPs in a certain time period. Within our configuration, you can set that time period. It's basically, am I being overwhelmed with traffic? Is he attempting a stick or a snot attack on me? Basically, you want to be able to divert that. Then you have, I can't see because there's a line right there. Have we seen this IP before?
Correct.
Is it still in the table? We all, like anything, you have a time frame. Most packets have a time frame where the state will stop maybe 1 hour, 2 hour. It all depends on your kernel. We have a time frame of, okay, this session we can just discard it. We want to know if it's still within that time frame. Have we seen this before? This makes it a little bit faster so we don't have to, oh, wait, blah, blah, blah. Oh, wait, we don't have to mess with him again. Now, one thing is, while this whole process is going, you do have a one or two packet loss because the data flow is not stopping. But of course, in future releases, we will remedy that. Just wanted to let y'all know that. And then you have, after we identify if we've seen it again, we pass it on to IP tables and tell IP tables, okay, we want you to mangle it. We want you to put a 1 in the mangle field. Go ahead and do that, and that'll tell our routing table, not the kernel routing table, our own specified routing table, to go ahead and do that. And that, of course, now comes the second layer of DOS protection. How many IPs are we seeing? Are we seeing too many? Not in the time frame, it's just in general, how many IPs are we seeing? And I can't read that last bit. Okay. And here comes Jason.
Okay, Hogwash. Hogwash is a kind of an all-in-one solution. I don't know if any of you guys have heard of Hogwash before. A couple of people. So Hogwash started out as basically inline snort. It's snort that would pass packets and drop packets based on signature matches. So you basically, all these nasty things people are throwing at my network, you know, just go ahead and drop them. Previously Hogwash has been based on snort, but I spent the last year or so ripping snort out and replacing with the H2 engine. So Devel 0.5 is not snort based anymore. I know everybody's sad about that, but just wasn't quite feasible anymore. So I've spent some time updating Hogwash to do bait and switch style routing. Oh, back one. So the major parts are the detection engine, and that's basically what replaced snort. Yeah, we thought we'd give you guys a show here. So there are parts. You've got the switch table. Anything in the switch table gets switched to the honeypot. You've got the notes table. What the notes table is used for is people coming back from the honeypot. So let's say you've got somebody coming from your production network reading CNN.com, and you've got somebody on your honeypot that's taken over and decides to read CNN.com for whatever reason. What the notes table does is it keeps track of state on the sessions like a NAT would, so that, you know, if somebody on the honeypot goes out to CNN.com, all CNN.com traffic doesn't get routed to the honeypot. The notes table is pretty much self-updating, so you don't have to play with it much. And then manglers, which are basically how do we want to modify the packets when we go on. So if you want to. So to set up Hogwash, you basically just have to install the software, enable bait and switch detection, say, you know, interface ETH1 is my production network, ETH2 is my honeypot, and it'll automatically detect the IPs. So any place where we've got an IP that's identical on your honeypot and your production network, it's going to say, okay, well, you want, you know, on all the rules, we want these switched over to my honeypot network. And you can set up the rules to trigger different switches. So if you got 18 different honeypots of different OSs of different flavors, you can say these rules switch to this honeypot. And it'll also automatically translate the MAC address if you want it to. So if you're on a Windows box and you don't want to bother going through all the little registry entries to switch the car in promiscuous mode and change the MAC address on the actual honeypot, then it will do the MAC address for you automatically. So the notes table. The notes table is only really important for a couple of reasons. So the notes table keeps state on outbound connections, but the notes table is only 128 entries long, and I did that on purpose. The reason the notes table is limited is so people can try like a single exploit outbound, but it acts as a connection limiting mechanism. So they can only have 128 possible simultaneous connections. So if somebody installs a DDoS agent on your network and start flooding out, they use up the first 128 entries in the notes table, and then the rest of it's all gone. They'll just drop it. So a lot of times they'll do their tests, and then when they start using up a lot of bandwidth, the notes table will kick in and limit their bandwidth. So, and then manglers. One of your problems with honeypots is people attacking other people from your honeypots. You know, this is bad. So at the very least, you want to take all your known exploits. As they come out of the honeypot, you know, drop them, you know, because if you go attack FBI.gov from your honeypot, then they'll get really mad at you. So help you limit some liability. But what manglers can do that are really cool is do replacements. So one of the manglers I stick in there is replace all instances of bin.sh with bin.hs. And so it's really funny to watch the attackers. They've got this known exploit. They know it's got to work. And they keep trying it over and over and over again, and you're just replacing the packet, recalculating the checksums, chunking it back on the wire. What's really cool is when they get really frustrated and then start downloading the source code and trying to figure out where their exploit's going wrong, and the mangler's basically protecting you because they need bin shell or Etsy password or whatever else, and you just replace it with something else. Or a single byte in the shell code is actually really insidious. So if you have a shell code detection routine, just go mangle a few bytes, and then it seg faults off, and then they brute force through the whole return address range, and you know they never get anywhere. So we set up one bait and switch honeypot for a research honeypot, and we just set a single rule in there. So anybody that tries a cmd.exe attempt against the box gets switched from the production box to the honeypot, and we left it to run for a month. And so most attackers ran by, a lot of them saw it was vulnerable and never bothered to attack it. You know, I figured, you know, hey, yeah, there's enough cmd.exe attempts out there this should be taken over in a matter of days. But no, they came, said, oh, yeah, this is vulnerable, and never bothered to take it over. Although during the month, there was actually one takeover. The attackers transferred the rootkit down in a fairly novel way. They echoed a bunch of ASCII characters to a file. So they called cmd.exe and then echoed a bunch of files to it, and then they invoked DOS's debug. And what they did was they actually wrote a little program in memory that opened the file, ran through all the ASCII characters, and converted them to a binary on the box to install the rootkit, and then they ran the binary. So I'd never seen it before. It was kind of cool. The other things they did were kind of cool, too. Right after that, they installed Kazaa Lite. I'm like going, why are you installing Kazaa on my box? What they used Kazaa to do was transfer down the real rootkit in an anonymous fashion. So they just did a search for whatever rootkit out on Kazaa, and you know, here comes the rootkit. And then they took a bunch of and transferred down a bunch of chunks of encrypted files, but they never transferred down the decryptor, so we didn't get to see what was in the encrypted files. But they were using using Kazaa as a kind of an anonymizer, and then they had a bunch of custom software where they were using Kazaa to chat anonymously. So they were creating little files, and then everybody would periodically grab these little files off of Kazaa so they could sit there and chat and not reveal who they were or who they were talking to. It was kind of cool.
All right, so we just gave a few examples of what we're doing use aggressive honeypots. But the point is really that rather than just having an idle machine sitting there, just like an old-style PC that wasn't connected to the net, you can add some intelligence, a little bit of logic to your system, It adds a layer of protection between your honeypot and your real system. Once you get switched, for example, with bait and switch, you can't touch that production machine. You can't touch the rest of the network. There's a lot of security in that. And when you add some sort of intelligence, you can tie multiple technologies together into one system that's a whole lot more effective than just sticking one vulnerable box out there. And again, different flavors of honey can attract different activity to the same pots. We're going to be using in the near future host-based, network-based, a combination of systems to direct traffic. What I'm pretty interested in is a lot of the encrypted traffic you won't be able to catch with the network intrusion detection system. We're going to be inserting some poison data into the databases, some poison files, some poison URLs. And we're going to have a host-based system talking back over. So if I insert, say, an all-alpha entry into a credit card database, and I see that traverse my network, or if I see someone access that locally on my production system, we're going to immediately switch them over and switch their session over to a honeypot, because there's absolutely no way that that's going to be live, real data. Again, with all the ways, different technologies there are for intrusion detection and for honeypots, you shouldn't just limit yourself to just open boxes. And particularly, we're looking for targeted systems. Anyone with a medical database, anyone with credit cards, anything that people are going to attack repeatedly can benefit from switching or from intelligent honeypots and aggressive honeypots. I would not recommend sticking any of this out on the internet. If someone's just going to be scanning your systems over and over again, just installing basic rootkits just to jump off. Thanks. This probably isn't a terribly good idea. What I am looking at is medical companies, legal, energy, anyone who has a legal requirement to control their data needs to use something like this. For example, we have there's two networks. One's a contractor, one's the actual client. There's a DMZ between. Well, what you would do is you would stick a system like this in the middle on the DMZ, and if you see documentation from one network traversing to the other one that should not cross, you can switch them to honeypot, because that's not an accident. Those are internal people. Those are not just some kids or somebody on your network actively targeting your systems, and you definitely want to find out who's doing it and why, because that's some serious damage that could occur. And we're going to open this up to questions shortly. These conclusions are pretty basic. If you're going to block people off, don't let them off very easily. If you're going to just run a honeypot, do something more interesting with it than just sitting it outside in a corner of your network somewhere. No one really touches that. They're not very useful, and you just don't get a whole lot out of them. Every once in a while, you'll have a zero day. Every once in a while, you'll see something interesting. But it's a huge – there's not a lot of payoff for them normally. And with JSONs, if you need new exploits, you can always run a honeypot. Impress your boss and do multiple things. And that's the contact info. Are there any questions? Or I think I actually forgot the Hogwash web, but I think that's at SourceForge. You should be able to search on that if you're not using that. No questions?
Everything that targets your Windows boxes, switch over to your Windows boxes. And then you have a better chance of figuring out what they're around. One of my favorites is I do a lot of work on securing power grids. And one of my favorites is having to go look at a compromise on a system that controlled a good chunk of the power for a city. And it's a Solaris box, and you come over there, and yep, there's the rootkit and everything. But what do you find on there? No, nobody's messing with the power. Nobody's trying to mess with the power. They took over the box, installed an FTP server, and started uploading girly movies to it. So If you just were to drop all that stuff, then you never would have known that these people just, you know, didn't care that this box controlled the power for half the city. They just wanted another host for the girly movies. So, any other questions? Cool. Well, thanks for coming, and if you have any questions, we'll be up here.